talk this morning about the following of Jesus, biblical parallels in the life of Catherine McAuley. I'll be talking about three gospel scenes. I'll pause briefly after the first one, just so we aren't racing from one set of thoughts into another. And then we'll pause for a greater length of time after the second and have our coffee break. And then I'll pick up and do the third. And there should be, at both times, plenty of time for reflections on your part or questions. Catherine McAuley probably did not read the Bible directly as we do, but the content of her prayer, her meditation, her action was richly biblical. Her own personal meditation book, which became the meditation book of the Bagot Street community, was entitled Journal of Meditations for Every Day of the Year, a work first printed in Latin in London in 1630. The work was later revised and reissued by Bishop Richard Challoner, who was vicar apostolic of the London district in the 18th century. Catherine's personal copy of Journal of Meditations for Every Day of the Year was printed in Dublin in 1823 and is now preserved in the archives of the Sisters of Mercy in Tullamore. Every time I'm fortunate enough to get to Tullamore, I try to photocopy a few more pages of it. According to Mary Claire Moore, Catherine's Journal of Meditations for Every Day of the Year was used as the meditation book of the Bagot Street community from at least June 1829 on. Claire notes in her letter of September 1st, 1844, "At six, we assembled in choir and said morning prayer, which was only the act of oblation, then meditation in the journal till seven, I think." The act of oblation that she's referring to is what we know as the act of consecration of Catherine McAuley, and it appears in both the Newman and the Bolster edition of her letters. The act of oblation was in another prayer book that Catherine McAuley used, William Gahan's Catholic Piety. And there it's called an act of oblation, and Catherine took her pen and made slight revisions in the prayer in Gahan's edition, and she moved one paragraph that was at the end earlier in the prayer. She also transcribed the prayer, and there is a manuscript copy in her handwriting. There's one in Silver Springs, Maryland, in the United States, and there may be other copies. I think she copied it out so that members of the community would have copies of the act of oblation, but it's really not an original prayer with her. That prayer, if you're interested in it, also appears in a small edition that was published a couple years ago called Praying with Catherine McAuley, that some of your communities may have. In the Derry manuscript, written by Mary Ann Doyle, Catherine's associate, Mary Ann also says that their morning prayer consisted chiefly of the act of oblation, followed by a meditation from the journal. And before Catherine read the daily text to the community, she evidently prayed on their behalf, a preparatory prayer before meditation, which she copied on a blank page in the front of her copy of the Journal of Meditations. The meditations in the Journal of Meditations are very biblically grounded, with at least 360 of the 420 pages devoted to reflection on the life and teaching of Jesus Christ. Moreover, as you will have gathered by now, the texts of many other spiritual books which Catherine is known to have read, such as Rodriguez's Practice of Christian and Religious Perfection, are heavily scriptural in their presentations. Thus, when Claire Moore records in the Practical Sayings that Catherine used to say, "The study of a religious should be the life and maxims of Jesus Christ," she is also describing Catherine's own reading and study. Elizabeth Davis, a Sister of Mercy from Newfoundland, whom some of you may know, has written a brilliant but so far unpublished paper on Catherine Macaulay's interpretation of Scripture. I'm urging her to publish it soon. Davis concludes that Catherine consciously created a community willing to shape itself by responding to the norm presented by the Gospels. She continues, "She was actively engaged in a dialogue between the world of the biblical text and her world of 19th century Ireland. And she sought in the scriptures a means of transformation and action for change in her world." The Bermondsey Annals tells us that when Catherine instructed the sisters, she loved to dwell on the words of Jesus. And she used to say, "If his blessed words ought to be reverenced by all, with what loving devotion ought the religious impress them on her memory and try to reduce them to practice?" In the course of some limited mercy retreat work over the last 5 years, I have tried to reflect on what must have been Catherine's dialogue with the gospel texts, as revealed occasionally in her words, but chiefly in her lifestyle, her example, and actions. In particular, I'd like now to share what I take to be her personal responses to three gospel stories about women whom Jesus helped: the widow in the temple, the daughter of Jairus, and the hemorrhaging woman. So first, let's think about the poverty of the widow in the temple. Luke tells us in chapter 21 that once when Jesus was in the temple, he looked up and saw rich people putting their gifts into the treasury. He also saw a poor widow put in 2 small copper coins. He said, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them, for all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in all she had to live on." Catherine Macaulay had the widow's sense of the completeness of the gift she was asked to give. In the end, she gave to the work of mercy and to all the demands of being a Sister of Mercy, not out of her abundance, but out of her poverty. Like the widow, she gave everything she had, all she had to live on. It's all well and good to give solace and comfort out of our abundance, to be merciful out of our riches, to give what is left over, whatever resources, energy, time, or capacity we have stored up and don't really need, our surplus. But Jesus was moved by the self-forgetful widow because her generosity was far deeper than that. She gave out of her poverty, her deficit. She gave all she had to live on. She gave her 2 copper coins. Her self-sacrifice was indeed a sacrifice. I do not think we can ever appreciate what Catherine Macaulay was and did, or grasp the deep story of her mercifulness, if we think of her as forever an heiress, giving out of her convenient abundance. By 1834-35, the bulk of her inheritance was, if not all gone, nearly gone. And yet her life's work, the work of mercy, and the new foundations of the Sisters of Mercy was just beginning in poverty. The biographical manuscripts written by Catherine's companions tell us about the scanty meals at Bagot Street, the cheap hair mattresses made not of horsehair, but of some foul-smelling dog's or cow's hair. They tell us about the community's radical yearly dependence on the proceeds of bazaars and charity sermons. They tell us that Catherine often gave up her own bed, that her underclothing was of the meanest description. I sometimes think that's the only way in which I am similar to her. They tell us that because she served others, her own meals were often only nominal. And that in beginning new foundations, she often slept on the floor rather than delay starting the works of mercy until the convent was adequately prepared. And this was the woman who once owned Kulak House and its 22-acre estate, who once drove a Swiss carriage and dressed well, and who once, according to Marianne Doyle, lived in what is usually called good style. I think Catherine understood the voluntary embrace of poverty and a simple lifestyle in three ways: as companionship with Jesus in his self-emptying embrace of human life with all its aspects of poverty, as a necessity if one wishes to give one's all wholeheartedly to the urgent work of mercy, and as solidarity with those who are materially poor. Beneath her desire to endure and welcome privations for the sake of the works of mercy was not any particular relish for the privations of material poverty or any romantic view about them, but rather her deep desire to resemble Jesus Christ, who, though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. In the chapter of the Rule on Poverty, she said that the sisters, and you will recall these words, I'm sure, she said that the sisters should frequently revolve in mind how tenderly Jesus Christ cherished holy poverty. Born in a stable, laid in a manger, suffering hunger, cold, and thirst in the course of his mortal life, having not a place to lay his head, naked on the cross, he consecrated this virtue in his sacred person and bequeathed it as a most valuable patrimony to his followers. And then she goes on, the sisters shall therefore keep their hearts perfectly disengaged from all affection to the things of this world, content with the food and raiment allowed them, and willing at all times to give up whatever has been allotted to them. Nothing shall appear in their dress but what is modest and grave, nor can they keep in their cells anything superfluous, costly, or rich in furniture or decorations. Catherine probably would not want us to look really shabby, or to sleep on dog's hair or cow's hair mattresses. But each of us probably has something to examine as she reads this chapter of the original rule and remembers the example of Catherine Macaulay. We know about Catherine's early and insistent dreams, long before she ever knew she would receive an inheritance, her dreams about renting a couple of rooms in which to shelter and teach homeless young girls and women. We know about her bringing Mrs. Harper, a maniac, we are told, from her hovel on a slum street of Dublin into Kulak House to live, even though the poor woman developed a hatred for Catherine, stole and hid household things that were needed, and, according to Willie Macaulay, kept mice and crackers in her apron pockets. We know about Catherine's carrying home orphans whom she found cast out on the streets, and about her ready welcoming of runaway girls and total strangers in distress through the doors at Bagot Street. Catherine's acts of solidarity with all of these poor women and girls are silent symbols of her life that invite our contemplation and our personal and communal transformation. One way or another, consciously or unconsciously, the Levite's excuse has often asserted itself in our lives, and we have passed by on the other side of the street, only too aware of the truly radical change in our lives that genuine solidarity with poor people lying on the road will require. To be in solidarity with those who are poor is to be so intimately united to them as to assume their needs, sufferings, oppressions, fears, hopes as one's own. To be solidly joined to another is to so identify with the condition of the other as to co-suffer with him or her. Solidarity with those who are poor, if it is genuinely Christian, involves, as it did for Catherine Macaulay, an inner and an outer communion, a spiritual solidarity and a bodily solidarity. When spiritual solidarity with those whom the world calls the least truly animates our hearts, as it animated the heart of Catherine Macaulay, we reverence the suffering God concealed and revealed in their eyes. We feel their temporary and their permanent privations and dreams as our own. We take into our hearts and grieve their daily needs. We regret the discrepancies between their lives and our own. We patiently bear our own small sufferings in company with their larger ones. In all these ways, and many more, we live interiorly in contemplative solidarity with them in their material poverty, seeing their suffering not only as an incarnation of our common creaturely poverty, which Christ embraces, but also as the privileged place where the God of the prophetic work of liberating justice cries out for our hands and voices. Bodily solidarity with those who are economically poor includes, as it did for Catherine, all those little ways in which we try to live and act in thoroughly honest communion with the life experiences of those who are poor, as well as all the big ways to which such honesty leads us. It involves the conversion of our lifestyle and ministries. Such solidarity asks us to think twice about buying more clothes, to not complain about our own food or material circumstances, to forego some expenditures on ourselves, to check our wasteful impulses, to resist the allure of trinkets and gadgets, to find ways to redistribute our wealth, to make all our personal and communal decisions about material things in the vividly remembered presence of dejected faces, of those in our world who suffer profound economic poverty. Bodily solidarity with those who are poor also calls us, as it did Catherine Macaulay, to deeper, more bone-testing acts of individual and communal solidarity. Perhaps giving up our present work in favor of work that more directly accompanies the daily liberation of poor people. Perhaps leaving the comfort of our current home in order to form one to serve the poorest people of our region. Re-examining what we intend by retirement. Deliberately setting aside our corporate lifestyle, so dependent on large salaries, and choosing instead work among those who are the poorest of the materially poor. Noticing and forsaking our extravagances and the subtle escalation by which we keep up with the Joneses. More strongly and consistently protesting the local and global oppressions of those who are exploited and ignored as the least. Designing alternatives to the way things are. Catherine Macaulay was the widow who gave her all. She gave out of her abundance initially, but then out of her deficit. She gave all she had to live on. And when she died, as Mary Vincent Whitty tells us, she was, as she had been in life, a picture of total abandonment of herself and all that belonged to her into the hands of God. The heart and life of Catherine Macaulay is the Markan story of Jesus' raising of the daughter of Jairus. I see in this story the outstretched hand of Catherine Macaulay. As you recall, Jesus responded to Jairus' expression of need. Even though a great crowd was pursuing him around the Sea of Galilee, Jesus went with Jairus, and the crowd followed him. And when he went into the room where the dead child lay, he took her by the hand and said, "Little girl, get up." And she got up and walked about. Then he told her family to give her something to eat. We cannot bear any literal resemblance to this ministry of Jesus, and neither could Catherine McCauley. She could not raise the physically dead back to life, and neither can we. But there is a spiritual restoration of life that we are called to assist and nurture every day of our lives by our own outreaching human hand of mercifulness. Over and over and over, I think Christ asked Catherine and asks us to take people by the hand, young people and older people, and say to them, "Talitha cum, my dear one, arise." Sometimes when we speak of the works of mercy, we focus almost spiritual works of mercy, not to the neglect of the corporal works, but to address the ultimate spiritual needs of people, beyond and deeper than their corporal thirst or hunger or nakedness. And the whole ministry of Catherine McCauley, with all its very practical, concrete, bodily expressions, was principally directed toward the deepest spiritual miseries of people. They're not knowing that God loves them. They're feeling guilty and unforgiven. Their fear of death. They're feeling weak or lonely or inadequate. Their discouragement. Their desolation. Perhaps it's time that we think more explicitly about the spiritual works of mercy. Sorry. Perhaps it's time that we think more explicitly about the spiritual works of mercy and time to renew our understanding of the spiritual raising from the dead that is the very heart of what it means to serve the poor, the sick, and the ignorant. You recall these spiritual works of mercy, instructing the ignorant and helping people to understand the word and ways of God, all of the informal and formal spiritual guidance we're called upon to offer, counseling the doubtful and strengthening those who feel weak, our conversations at work, encouraging the failing and those who feel they have sinned, all of those who confide in us, bringing consolation and comfort to the sorrowful at wakes and funerals, and especially in the days afterwards, forgiving injuries and helping others to forgive, asking pardon, and helping people over the humps of their anger, bearing wrongs patiently, and helping others to bear them patiently, praying with the living and the dying and the dead. When I think of Catherine McCauley, in relation to these spiritual works of mercy, and in relation to the daughter of Jairus, I think of all the ways she raised people to new life by her kindness, her help, her good example. She refused admission at the Refuge of the Sisters of Charity on Stanhope Street because their non-resident admission committee would not be meeting for several days. But she was told there that, and I'm quoting, "In Bagot Street, a Miss Macaulay has a great house where every sort of people were let in." Catherine not only gave the girl bread and milk and found her a place to sleep, she gave her peace and hope and new skills and a chance to grow. She took her by the hand and lifted her up. In the chapter of her rule on the admission of distressed women, we see how anxious Catherine was to help the girls and women in the House of Mercy to learn the skills they would need to live a safe and happy life. In this almost business-like chapter, she writes, "Suitable employment shall be sought for and great care taken to place them in situations for which they are adapted, in order that they may continue such length of time in their service as shall establish a character," that is, the grounds for a positive recommendation, "on which they can depend for future support. Many leave their situations not so much for want of merit as incapacity to fulfill the duties they unwisely engaged in. They shall not be encouraged to remain long in the house, as it will generally be found more conducive to their good to get them soon into the state and employment by which they are to live." Catherine took the hand of these homeless street girls and unemployed servant women and lifted them up. "My dear one, arise." In the chapter of her rule on the visitation of the sick, Catherine speaks of our presence to the sick and dying. Sometimes we're very timid about speaking of God to sick people. And when we are silent about the hope that is within us, we fail them in a deep spiritual way. Here, Catherine describes our conversation with the dying. "When recovery is hopeless, it must be made known with great caution, and if time permits, done by degrees, assuring them of the peace and joy they will feel when entirely resigned to the will of God, inducing them to pray that God may take all that concerns them into his divine care and dispose of them as he pleases. Let the sisters, if possible, promise attention to whatever object engages their painful, anxious solicitude, that the mind may be kept composed to think of God alone." When the rule was sent to Rome for approval in early 1840, officials there changed the last sentence of the paragraph I just read. The sentence, "Let the sisters, if possible, promise attention to whatever object engages their painful, anxious solicitude." Evidently, Rome was afraid that the sisters would get caught up in family finances. But Rome had no idea about the poverty and dire circumstances of the people Catherine was talking about the sick and dying poor in slum hovels, and their need for peace of mind. To these, Catherine offered her outstretched hand, her consoling prayer, and her promise to care for their impoverished families. There is a danger that we will treat our vow of service to the poor, the sick, and the ignorant as a division of labor. leaving care of the poor to those who work directly with people who are economically poor, leaving care of the ignorant to those who teach in classrooms, and care of the sick to those who work in hospitals, clinics, or nursing homes. By this supposed division of labor, we each attempt to fulfill one-third of our vow of service, locating ourselves somehow in one part of it. But the example of Catherine Macaulay throughout her life and the very words of the vow are intense reminders that the visitation and care of the sick, for example, is a central aspect of the vocation of each one of us, and a profound way in which we can be faithful to the spiritual works of mercy by actually visiting those who are sick or dying, by speaking explicitly to them of God's unfailing affection for them and ours, by giving them the chance to express their deepest spiritual needs, and by praying with them. When we hold out our hand to them, we are with them leaning on the promise and fidelity of a mindful and humbly merciful God, who in the raising of the daughter of Jairus and irrevocably in the resurrection of Jesus has promised us all the restoration of our truest, most beautiful, and lasting life. In countless ways, Catherine Macaulay gently held out her hand to the daughter of Jairus and said to her and to countless homeless, uneducated, sick, and dying women, men, and children, "My dear one, arise." I think Catherine Macaulay asks us to ask ourselves now and each day, are my hands an instrument of God's mercy? Who needs my outstretched hand? Who needs to hear me say, "My dear one, arise"? Who needs the bread and milk of encouragement and hope? Who needs the testimony of my joy and faith? Who, within our communities and beyond, needs our spiritual works of mercy? Who needs the gift of renewed life that is in the words, "Talitha cum"? who suffer is their thirst for the merciful consolation of God. Like the hemorrhaging woman, she had enormous confidence in the approachable providence and mercy of God, not primarily for her own sake, but for the sake of those she sought to serve. She knew that the charity of God would not avail us if it is not rendered practical for us in God's mercy that comes to our assistance in tangible ways. And I think she too wore the great cloak of vulnerability to human need. If we claim to be followers of Jesus Christ and followers of Catherine Macaulay, I think we have to ask ourselves whether this gospel story, this deep story of Catherine's life, is now being narrated in our own lives. Have we, like Jesus and Catherine, moved into the pressing crowds of those who suffer? Or has our ministry now become safely and comfortably tidy and predictable? Do the long suffering and the alleged unclean of our society, of our time and place, really feel they can reach out and touch us for help and comfort? Do they ever touch us? Or do they keep their distance? Do we keep our distance from them? Are we really sensitive to their timid approaches? Do we do what we can to heal their afflictions, even if this costs us personal poverty and the scorn of other disciples of Jesus? Are our communities approachable for those who suffer? Do they know they can ring our doorbells? Do we have doorbells? Do we, most of us, offer the afflicted of our world the explicit consolation of God? Do we do this individually and corporately? Are we ever criticized? For what? If we are never criticized for our works of mercy, we might get a little suspicious. Do we, like Catherine, wear the merciful cloak of vulnerability to human need? Are we known publicly as people who can be touched for help, as people from whom some sort of healing will come forth? This is the kind of person Catherine was. And this is what the Bagot Street community was all about. Catherine was herself a healing cloak, a house of mercy, a place of refuge, a garment that could be touched, a locus of God's compassion. In her own person, a healing of humiliation and sorrow. To illustrate her fidelity to this gospel story, let me recall for you just one prolonged moment in the story of Catherine's life, the building and the opening of the commercial laundry at Bagot Street. The laundry was a headache from start to finish, while it was under construction and long afterward. And it was not a roaring success financially when it was in operation. But the heart that built it And the hope Catherine had for it revealed the kind of vulnerability to human need that we've been talking about. For me, the most moving aspect of the story of this laundry is Catherine's willingness to take a huge risk for the sake of the women and girls in the House of Mercy. She, who, when she started, knew nothing about running a commercial laundry. But she had been touched by their need, by their humiliating lack of employable skills, and she gave all she had to heal it. The Limerick manuscript, written by Mary Vincent Harnett, tells us about the birth of this idea. She writes, "By this time," and she's probably talking about 1833 or 1834, "the charitable objects of the Institute began to be rather generally known, and many, besides contributing money, sent plain work, that is sewing, to be done by the young women of the House of Mercy, the payment for which helped to defray some of the expenses of their maintenance. When the number of inmates amounted to between 50 and 60, Reverend Mother perceived the necessity of adopting some further means of contributing to their support, for the average time of residence being only about 4 months, and the greater number requiring instruction in almost everything necessary for them to know, they could not consequently earn much, that is, earn much either outside the house as servants or inside the house doing the plain work. She likewise saw the great good likely to arise from giving constant occupation to such a large number of persons residing together." Somewhere in one of her letters, Catherine says, she begins to see the wisdom of Archbishop Crowley's comment about too many women living together. For her, too many was, well, it could have been 90, 60 in the House of Mercy and 30 plus in the convent. She likewise saw the great good likely to arise from giving constant occupation to such a large number of persons residing together, and therefore set herself to devise some suitable and at the same time remunerative work. After some deliberation, she decided on erecting a building for a public laundry. But as this was an arduous undertaking, and the many calls for immediate support and protection, keeping a constant drain on the funds, she had to defer the execution of her project for some years. In her memoir, The Foundress, Claire Augusta Moore picks up the story at that point, and she writes, "In 1838, a legacy of £1,000 was bequeathed to the Institute." Now, that's the same year of the chaplaincy crisis, but also of the Kingston crisis, where there is this £375-400 debt. "In 1838, a legacy of £1,000 was bequeathed to the Institute, and Foundress resolved to build the laundry, hoping that the labor of the inmates might be able to render the House of Mercy self-supporting, as the closing of the chapel had greatly curtailed our resources. But the expense of the building greatly exceeded her calculations, and the building itself was a continual worry. Neither were the returns, when it was built, at all equal to her expectations. In fact, for long after her death, they were miserably insignificant." You can always count on Claire Augusta Moore to be blunt in her assessments. From April 1838 to July 1840, when the laundry was finally operational, Catherine was alternately full of hope at the success it would be and disappointed to find that the well-known architect who designed it had made no plans for putting in laundry equipment. In April 1838, she wrote to Francis Ward and Carlo. We are likely to have the long-desired laundry built this season. Through the providence of God and the kindness of Mr. O'Hanlon, Confessor Begut Street, we have got a legacy nearly equal to the expense. What a comfort if I am permitted to see some secure means of supporting our poor women and children, not to be entirely depending on daily collections, which are so difficult to keep up. The daily collections were door-to-door collections, begging blankets, clothing, food for the House of Mercy. That went on from before Catherine went to George's Hill until probably 1841. I mean, she's saying in 1838 that they're still dependent on this. What a comfort if I am permitted to see some secure means of supporting our poor women and children established, not to be entirely depending on daily collections, which are so difficult to keep up. We would soon have a valuable laundry, as the neighborhood is so good. In May of the same year, she told Francis, I did hope our laundry would have commenced by this, but no, delays innumerable. What I would not go through to see it at full work. New persons coming into the neighborhood every day. We are asked to take washing. Since the Townsend Street Asylum was moved to Donnybrook, we have constant application. That is, for laundry. Yesterday, it went to my heart to send away a large parcel which would have paid well. In one institution, they earned £700 in 14 months, clear of all expenses. We must give up the garden for drying ground and grass plot. God grant it may soon be done. But by November 1839, just before she sailed for London to establish the Bermondsey Foundation, Catherine suspected trouble in the construction of the laundry. In February 1840, after she returned from Bermondsey, her fears about the lack of water pipes and laundry equipment were confirmed, and she wrote to Charles Cavanaugh, the community's ever-helpful solicitor, I enclose you a copy of the two notes I wrote to Mr. Mullins, he was the architect, which he terms graciously offensive. Inasmuch as he has made himself a very principal party, complaints must necessarily be addressed or referred to him. The man called the contractor, that is, the actual builder, could not alter the most glaring defect without his permission. My first note was occasioned by receiving three messages from Mr. Mullins, requesting I would give directions for the water pipes, not clearly saying it was not part of the contract work, but that I wrote so well. This inclined me suspect, and when I decidedly refused to give the order, Brophy, the builder, told me it would be an extra charge. I've seen the bill for the additional work done on the laundry. It was unbelievable. I mean, water troughs and water access pipes and sewage and all kinds of provisions that would have been needed for a room in which laundry was going to be done on a large scale had been left out and were billed extra. She goes on in this letter to the lawyer, I then wrote to Mr. Mullins, and next day the work was begun. Immediately after my second note, the man, that is the laborer, was taken away, bed and all, in 2 hours. The keys have been given to us. It is an unkind, unjust transaction. I have good reason to say so. On February 29, 1840, Catherine wrote to Elizabeth Moore about the unfinished laundry. "The new laundry is all lost so far, but we must work on. A year, please God, will bring it forward." Finally, by July 1840, on Catherine's return from Galway, the laundry was at last operational, and she again wrote, full of hope, to Frances Ward. "Sister Agatha, head laundress, very diligent, getting on pretty well. These things take time. The expense of coal is very great, sometimes a ton a week. You may suppose the work must be very great that would leave much surplus after this, soap, etc. But the fire will not cost more when the work is much increased, as the hot closet must be prepared in the same manner for a small or large quantity. We have not lost anything of consequence, and only a few borders of fashionable nightcaps torn." Are you familiar with a hot closet? Yes and no. My vision of a hot closet, and I once saw one in London in a building that I swear was built before Charles Dickens was born. Think of a 4 or 5 drawer file, a tall metal contraption that has really only one drawer in it. And when you pull that drawer out, you have bars inside. And you hang your wet clothing on the bars, and you push the drawer back in, and the whole contraption is next to your furnace, which you've got to keep hot, a ton a week of coal, and your clothes get dried inside this hot closet. And of course, Catherine is saying, even if they've only got a little bit of laundry, they still have to heat the furnace and heat the hot closet, but she's hopeful they will have a large quantity. In Catherine Macaulay's dear, sensitive heart, the laundry was one practical way, though hiddenly risky, of healing the hemorrhaging of the poor, beloved girls and women in the House of Mercy. And there is something for us to learn and take to heart in her reenactment of the gospel story. The danger for each of us and for our communities and congregations is that we start to get impressed, perhaps even over-impressed, with the societal values of security, convenience, sound financial management, personal comfort, and well-organized calendars. We may even overplay and treat as too decisive the risks involved in some work of mercy. From what I know of Catherine Macaulay, I do not think I am overstating her desires for us if I let her ask us these questions. What long-standing hemorrhaging are you going to try to heal next week, next year? What laundry have you built lately? And what laundry are you going to resolve to build? What vulnerability to the voiceless, timid approaches of those who have long suffered do you feel? And when and how will you urge yourself to respond? I want to conclude by reading you a passage from your own constitutions, which I regard as the most inspiring contemporary mercy constitutions I have read. In this passage, from Article 3, you have already committed yourselves, at least in words, to the generous poverty of the widow, to the spiritual restoration of Jairus' daughter, and to the vulnerable, practical responsiveness to those who are hemorrhaging. Article 3 reads, "The church incessantly reminds us that to be truly poor for Christ's sake is to be open to the rejected and abandoned, and to experience personally their misery and distress. It is to be awakened to whatever oppression exists in our midst, and to allow the oppressed to question our fidelity to the gospel, demanding solidarity from us. It is to answer the urgent call made by the gospel and the church to cooperate with God and with the poor in building the new earth, the place where righteousness and love and mercy will be at home. I beg you, very simply, and with the promise of my own love and comparable effort, to lean on the example and presence of Catherine McCauley as you seek to fulfill those words.